Got on calendar is docket number 77485, Smith versus State Board of Wildlife Commissioners. Counsel, are you ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. If you would come on up. And would you like to reserve a little time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, fine.
May it please the court, my name is Jeffrey A. Dickerson. I'm an attorney in Reno, Nevada. I represent the appellants in this case, which consists of Donald Moldy and Mark E. Smith and the Mark E. Smith Foundation. The appellants brought an action for declaratory and injunctive relief and writ relief against the commission, the Board of Wildlife Commissioners, I'll refer to as the commission, and against the Nevada Department of Wildlife, which we refer to commonly as NDOW in the business. The court is probably well familiar with the briefing to date on this case and the records that's on file and the procedural niceties and events that transpired down below. I'd like to go right straight to the heart of the issue that I think is the main issue on appeal. The procedural issues I think could be tackled without oral argument, but if you have specific questions about procedural matters, jurisdictional matters, I'd be glad to answer them as I proceed. The legislature enacted NRS 503.5703, and this is required for trapping, and it mandates that a minimum visitation interval be 96 hours from the time the trap is placed. And in this particular legislative session that we're talking about here, SB 213, which is the statute now codified, as I just indicated, gave the commission discretion to determine whether the visitation period in any particular management area ought to be reduced from 96 to something else. In so doing, it stated the following language. In adopting the regulations, the commission shall consider requiring a trap, snare, or similar device placed in close proximity to a populated or heavily used area by persons to be visited more frequently than a trap, snare, or similar device which is not placed in close proximity to such an area. The legislature sent that out, and in response to it, the commission appointed a trapping subcommittee, and they went about the business of trying to figure out what the language I just read meant. And we've cited to various portions in the record, and I think we've even quoted some of it, if not paraphrased, most of what I think, what the appellants believe, demonstrates confusion on the part of the trapping subcommittee's members, including the chair and including a very influential member who I believe is in the courtroom today. There's a large amount of record in that regard to think about. But I don't think that there's any dispute about the confusion that the commission and its trapping subcommittee experienced. However, the issue here is one of law. It's one of law, and how they went about it was an issue that was going to be for trial in terms of whether or not they acted in an arbitrary or capricious manner. The issue that we're concerned about right now at this point of the argument is the whether or not the separation of powers doctrine has been violated by the manner in which the legislature laid down the guidelines of close proximity to a populated or heavily used area. And just looking at those words alone and using their plain meaning, I'm unable to discern, and so was the commission, what the guidelines really meant.
Well, isn't that a fact-finding issue? And isn't that exactly what they did?
Well, the legislature did not tell them what facts to find and did not give them a measure by which to examine those facts. So what is populated? How populated does it have to be? What's heavily used? How heavily used does it have to be? These guidelines did not provide that type of guidance. And based upon the Lookman doctrine that this court promulgated long ago, the guidelines have to be reasonable. They have to have meaning to them. They have to be able to be applied and guide the agency so that the agency's actions do not become arbitrary and capricious. And we maintain that's what happened in this record. They just reached out and did 24 hours around Reno and Las Vegas based on a map that somebody drew.
Well, that was after several hearings and hearing from interested parties, various stakeholders. So isn't that the kind of fact-finding that the legislature expected them to engage in?
We don't know. That's our position. It's worded in such a way that there is really no way to understand what the legislative intent was for this agency to do, other than consider reducing the visitation time, and in doing so, think about...
They, in fact, consider reducing the visitation time and reduced it in certain areas?
Yes, in two areas.
Okay.
For sure. And they considered the issue. They considered the non-target data that were presented by my clients. But the chaos in determining what exactly they were there to do is evident from that record. So if it is a question of fact, the record helps, I believe, us, helps the appellant's position, showing that this was arbitrary and capricious rulemaking, that there was no standard that they could logically and reasonably apply in a sensible manner.
Should they apply, in your opinion?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What standard should they apply, in your opinion?
I believe they should have directed them to rely upon NDOW data in making the determination of what should be a proper visitation period. And that would include the non-target data. And so where you see that there are anomalies with respect to that type of trapping, non-target trapping, that's something to be considered along with other things. But still, what is populated, what is heavily used? That language, if they didn't change that language, I don't know how much clearer they could be. So our position on this case, Your Honor, is that because the legislature did not provide a workable rule that is evident on the face of the statute and in practice, that this was arbitrary and capricious rulemaking, and the separation of powers doctrine that creates the exception for a fact-finding mission where there's reasonable guidelines is not met in this case, and therefore the regulation violates the separation of powers doctrine.
So what impact, if any, is there from the fact that the Legislative Commission itself ended up reviewing and, I guess, approving these regulations? How do we say they improperly delegated to somebody else? They actually have a process where they review and approve after the fact under a specific constitutional provision that we have in our Nevada Constitution.
True, but the question of whether or not the statute in the first place provided reasonable guidelines, I think, is the issue for this court. The courts are charged with trying to figure out whether the separation of powers doctrine has been violated, and it's one of the most sacrosanct doctrines that we have in our government, and that's our position on this case.
And so what's the... So what about the so if we're focused on the statute then, 503.570 sub 3, what about that is improper or unconstitutional?
The part I read, Your Honor, which is as the, in adopting the regulations, the commission shall consider requiring a trap placed in close proximity to a populated or heavily used area to be visited more frequently than a trap which is not placed.
And so why is that inadequate, and or what would it need to look like to pass muster?
Something more specific than populated. The populated, Elko is populated, Gabs is populated, heavily used. The gold mines are heavily used areas. You just don't know what they meant. It's not self-effectuating, shall I say. It's not self-enforcing. It doesn't provide guardrails for the administrative agency to follow with any measurable determination.
So the legislature itself, rather than the regulatory agency, would need to set out, you know, in counties over 100,000 people or in something like that?
Something like that would be great. That would pass muster, probably. If we look at the Luckman case, in that case, the question was whether or not the... I've got 5 minutes remaining, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal.
Okay, thanks.
Right. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. We want to talk about the issues that were just addressed, which are the focus of the appellant's brief on appeal, and that is the separation of powers doctrine issues. We will then discuss, wasn't discussed at any length here, but the injunctive and writ relief claims. But the focus, of course, of the brief is the separation of powers argument.
Because you're fairly tall, you're far from the mic, so I need you to speak up a little bit.
Sorry about that. Okay. I have the tendency to speak low. So the appellant's brief focuses on a single case, and that's the Luckman case decided by this court in 1985, which Sheriff's Clark County versus Luckman, in which this court considered what can be considered a very broad statutory authority, which was given to the pharmacy board to create a list of controlled substances, the results of which would create stronger or weaker criminal sanction for a violation or illegal activity related to it. Under that broad statute, this court considered the area of criminal conduct. They discussed the fact that the area of criminal conduct is exclusively within the jurisdiction of the legislative powers. It also noted that we would apply a higher or stricter scrutiny to delegation of authority of this sort of criminal sanction. Even under that case, this court upheld a regulation that was adopted by the pharmacy board, which created this list of controlled substances. We would compare that to the fairly narrow delegation of authority or fact-finding mission in this case, where the legislature said, hey, we're going to get a 96-hour maximum. We're already telling you 96 hours is the limit of a trap check intervals. But all we want you to do is look at the potential for a shorter trap check interval for these areas that are in proximity to heavily used or populated areas. So we believe that case is illustrative of how the court should find here. This regulation or this statute is clearly much more narrow and sufficiently definite under the Frederick standard or case that we cited, and should be upheld on that.
So did the legislature have to be more specific about what it means by what are populated areas that the agency was charged to consider?
No, I want to argue that in context of the statute as a whole, if we can talk about that. The appellants try and create ambiguity or vagueness in the statute by defining or isolating heavily and used and populated and saying by themselves they're vague and ambiguous. But the statute has to be considered as a whole, as a rule of construction, and the statute itself starts with the umbrella of trapping. So we're talking about the subject matter of trapping. And within that context, what the legislature said is we want you to look at this narrow issue of shorter trap check intervals for these heavily used and populated areas. And of course, they contrast that in the statute with the other areas of the state that they say will have this 96-hour maximum. So taken as a whole, taken in context of trapping activities, it makes sense. And of course, the proof is in the pudding. If you look at the regulation that was adopted through 7 different hearings by the Wildlife Commission, including a review by the Legislative Commission, a review by the Legislative Council Bureau, who made some changes to the statute, then another review by the Legislative Commission for the statutory propriety and the regulatory propriety, including, because it took 2 years for this regulation to be drafted, a whole legislative session passed in which the legislature had an opportunity to review this proposed regulation and decided that they didn't want to take it on or change the statute in any way. So considering the issues of both what the Wildlife Commission took on, the way they did it, which is, of course, not challenged. The process is not challenged here. It's only the result, or the statutory vagueness, of course, is challenged as well. But under that, reviewing it as a whole, considering what happened with the legislature and its opportunity to review the statute and the regulation, it's our contention that the separation of powers doctrine was not violated. The appellants also argue that on its face, the delegation by the legislature to the Wildlife Commission was somehow inappropriate because the Wildlife Commission lacked expertise. The Wildlife Commission, of course, had decades of experience in trapping activities, supervised trapping activities in the state, decided which devices can and can't be used when you trap, how long those seasons should last. They also have at their disposal Department of Wildlife professionals, including wardens and biologists, who can then give them advice about the concerns that may be addressed under heavily used or populated areas as it relates to trapping, as well as, of course, they had this robust process, this open meeting process, where the entire state had the opportunity, wildlife advocates, trappers, et cetera, could then address these issues before the Wildlife Commission with that expertise and make a determination of how this map should be drawn. Of course, the map was drawn and determinations were made. And in fact, a shorter check interval was adopted by the Wildlife Commission. The second issue we'd like to address.
Could you clarify for me how the map was drawn, how it came about, and how it was modified, if any?
I think those facts are in the record, but in essence.
To clarify that.
Okay. In essence, we had a deputy director who's actually here who initially took up drawing the map and considered these, if you look at the map around Southern California and the populated areas of, Southern Nevada, the populated areas around Las Vegas, they decided, okay, that includes these sort of congested areas around Las Vegas that are already defined by Las Vegas that kind of helped us out in drafting those issues. And then in Northern Nevada, they simply looked at these sort of issues about where the urban population was and where people were engaged in sort of recreational activities in a certain volume that created a concern or a need for a shorter check interval. And that's how it was come on, how they came up with the mapping. Thank you, Your Honor. So the next issue I want to address, because it was addressed by the appellant again, and that is this arbitrary and capricious standard that they somehow argue that they're entitled to have in this case, to have reviewed in this case. Judge Simons below addressed this very well. It took a while to get there, admittedly, in the process of the motions filing in this case, but she did finally get to this issue, noting that, unfortunately, there was a little misleading case law going on where there was a citation to federal authorities that didn't apply, of course, to a Nevada Administrative Procedure Act issue, separate statutory scheme, separate rights that exist in the federal cases. And then Judge Simon went and looked at the Nevada Administrative Procedure Act, and she noted all the cases. And in fact, the appellants continue to cite these cases before this court, even though they have no application. And I would point out the Villa versus Arrizabalaga case, the Lawrence case, City Council versus Irvine case of 1986, the Henderson versus Henderson auto trucking case of 1961. Every single case is a contested case, a quasi-judicial function case. In other words, cases that were decided by this court about the quasi-judicial function of an executive agency. Contested cases, cases where the appellants had some wrong that occurred, or the petitioners had some wrong occur at the executive agency level, and then went ahead and contested it. That is not what is before this case. This is the rulemaking function under the Nevada Administrative Procedure Act. This is the first part of the statute, and under the rulemaking function, they're not entitled to arbitrary and capricious in review. And how do we know that? You can look at the second section of the statute, which is the contested case section, and it says that they're entitled to arbitrary and capricious review. If the court decided that they were entitled to some review other than declaratory relief under 110, then the court could, the statute of the legislature could have said that. But the legislator didn't say that as to rulemaking. And that makes sense. If you're going to try and, if you have a dispute with rulemaking that's engaged in by an executive body, you would want to bring a declaratory relief action. Does it violate a constitutional right? Does it violate a statutory right in the rulemaking process? But there's no need for any additional relief, including all of this equitable relief, in the administrative rulemaking process, and there's no need for this arbitrary and capricious review. You have a review of the rulemaking through the declaratory relief action. So, but I just want to point out that the appellants continue to cite all these cases that have no application. The only case that does apply is the case cited by Judge Simon, and that was a Samantha case. It's decided by, you know, which Judge Pickering wrote about how there's administrative, that we're going to give discretion to administrative rulemaking, but also that the legislature could define what remedies you have, and what remedies the legislature gives you is what you're left with. And of course, they got relief here. I would point out that as it relates to the dismissal of the injunctive relief claim, Judge Simons pointed out that the appellants had the opportunity to go back to the legislative or to the Wildlife Commission. They could have had them review, sought that they amend the regulation, sought that they repeal it. They had that option. The other option they had, so they had two different remedies that they didn't pursue in this case. They had the option to go and pursue the Wildlife Commission making a change to that regulation, but they also had the potential for declaratory relief action under 110 as to the regulation, which they didn't pursue. So they had two different remedies that they had available to them that they didn't pursue. So the denial of injunctive relief, of course, fundamentally is about the fact that they weren't entitled to equitable relief under the Administrative Procedure Act claim challenging a regulation. That's, of course, the first part. But secondly, injunctive relief was not appropriate in this case. Why? Because if they had, in fact, brought a declaratory relief action under the Nevada Administrative Procedure Act, there was no constitutional claim made. It's not appropriate subject matter in this case for declaratory relief. The claim was not that there was some violation of the Constitution. In fact, the other issue is there's no statutory right that the claim was violated. In fact, if anything, they're saying it was too narrowly construed. The statute was too narrowly construed by the Wildlife Commission. There's not a claim that somehow it was extra statutory or that they infringed on some other statutory right of the plaintiffs or the appellants. That's not the claim that's presented here. Real quickly, even though it wasn't mentioned on the appellant's argument, we want to just talk about the writ relief. The writ relief, of course, was denied by the lower court because it's both extraordinary relief and it was a discretionary issue here. Writ relief is based in an issue of law that was violated. There was no claim of an issue at law that was violated by the appellants. Again, goes back to the argument I was just the point I was just making, and that is that the subject matter of the claim is not appropriate for both injunctive relief or declaratory relief or writ relief here, because they're not alleging some claim that was required or mandated this court to take action. With that, I don't have anything else to argue. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, to clarify for me, under your view, our review of this matter should be under 233B110.
Yes. If a proper claim for declaratory relief had been presented as to the regulation, that would be true. No claim was presented as to the regulation.
Isn't it the case? The last sentence says the court shall declare the regulation invalid if it finds that it violates constitutional or statutory provisions. So they're saying the entire regulation is violative of the Constitution because of the empowering statute being overbroad.
But Your Honor,
that's how I take Mr. Dickerson's argument.
I appreciate that. But Your Honor, they had to bring a claim for relief to get there. The first and third claims for relief were writ claims. The second claim for relief challenged the statute itself on a declaratory relief action. And the fourth claim for relief sought injunctive relief. None of those claims alleges the declaratory relief action as to the regulation. So it's not before the court.
Is that what Judge Simon found, though?
She actually...
I don't quite read her order that way.
I don't think she addressed the issue, honestly. We did address the issue in the briefs. But actually, she did. I take that back. In her order, she talked about the fact, and I think it's in a prior order in the case as well, where they talk about...
Well, I'm referring to what I consider to be the order we're reviewing, which is the clarifying order that tries to work through all of these various motions and prior orders.
And I appreciate that.
I believe that's the order that's on review to this court. And so I didn't, unless I missed something and I'm asking for clarification, I don't see where she concluded that there was a failure to state a claim for declaratory relief under the provisions of 233B110.
That was addressed in a prior order, you're right, I apologize. But...
Well, let's stick with this one. Am I correct? Am I... Just making sure I got out of bed on the right side. Did I read the order correctly or not?
You did. The reason why it's addressed here is because in the fourth claim for relief, which she's dealing with in this order, which is an injunctive relief claim, which she decided was not appropriate, declaratory relief was also asked for under injunctive relief. So therefore, the court dealt with that issue only under the guise of that claim. But that is not, the respondents would argue, and I think it's clear, that's not a proper claim for relief, for declaratory relief as to the regulation. That was not presented.
I understand your argument. It doesn't seem like the court's order that we're reviewing addressed that particular point. So what the judge does say... is she identifies what is the, what appears to be the correct statutory section for reviewing the validity of an agency rulemaking power, which is 233B110. And my reading of that statute says that the court can declare whether a regulation is invalid if there's a constitutional infirmity. Mr. Dickerson's argued to us today and to a degree in the briefs that there is a constitutional infirmity here because the language that delegates time periods less than 96 hours is overbroad.
I appreciate that.
I'd like you to address that, if you could, in the context of the order we're reviewing.
The issue of the constitutional infirmity went to the statute, not the regulation. That was the issue addressed by Judge Simons. That was not addressed by Judge Simons because that was not an issue before her, because she determined that injunctive relief was not available, which was the only way they sought declaratory relief. Therefore, the judge did not address that issue.
Okay. I understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The language of the statute as it relates to the regulation was mentioned in the First Amendment complaint, I believe, and was litigated throughout. If anything is less obvious than that, I don't know what could be. Both parties presented their arguments both ways on the issue that we're talking about today, and on two different occasions down below.
But what I'm struggling with, Mr. Dickerson, is the order that's on review to us. I don't read it as resolving whether the statute is unconstitutional. Do you maintain that the judge resolved that question in this order?
No, I think it was her prior order on the motion for partial summary judgment, where she ruled as a matter of law that the statute was a proper delegation of authority to the agency, and then sent forwarded for trial the issue of whether the rulemaking itself was arbitrary or capricious. and she actually, under Rule 56D, made that the law of the case specifically. Mm-hmm. So that is the law of the case. That carries forward to the final order. Mm-hmm. And that's how that gets to this court. And mm-hmm. so the issue is preserved for appeal. I don't think that's what your question was, but...
Well, I appreciate the clarification. And so, if you don't have it handy, maybe you and counsel could grab the record site of that order so that we have that, give that to the clerk when we're finished here. I want to make sure, there's a lot of orders in here, and I want to make sure I'm reading the correct order that was the subject of 56.
Yeah, that's the order that on our first motion for partial summary judgment, which we proactively prosecuted, they proactively defended, and she came up with the idea that the statute was okay. It passed constitutional muster because interpreting a statute is what an agency is supposed to do under the APA.
Now, Mr. Bergen argues that you didn't challenge the regulation itself. You only challenged the constitutionality of the statute. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't.
Okay. Where in your complaint do you challenge the constitutionality of the regulation?
Well, I think I've quoted in the brief, maybe not, but at least below I did, the portion of the First Amendment complaint, the amended complaint, that talks about the factual springboard for the entire claim, for the four claims for relief. And somewhere in there, I think we talk about the regulation not passing a muster. I don't know if we use the term constitutional or not, but Judge Simon's first order on our motion for partial summary judgment did recognize and address the separation of powers argument as vis-a-vis the regulation and the promulgation of the regulation. And she says, we're going to go to trial on that, on the rulemaking part of it. But as to the legislating part of it, she found it sound. And we can test that.
Okay.
In other words, if the statute doesn't provide constitutionally adequate guidelines, the regulation has to fail, necessarily. So there's some syllogism there, I think. Although it's been a while since I took logic. Thank you, Your Honors. Appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you, counsel, both of you. We appreciate you coming here today. And
Justice Berger, can I ask a question?
Sure. I'm looking at the record on appeal. I think it's 74 to 83. So I'm just seeking clarification if that's the order counsel has been referring to in which the district court resolved the constitutionality of the statute.
Court's indulgence?
Yes, of course.
The order to which I've been referring is an April 9th, 2017 order entitled Order Denying Motion for Partial Summary Judgment. This particular copy I have here doesn't have a record number on it, so I can't give you the appendix number. But,
April 10, 2017?
April 10th, 2017.
That's called the order that starts at 179 yeah. of the record.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay, counsel, thank you again, and this matter will stand submitted.